This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Good morning and welcome to Emerging Trends. I'm John Freeman, Communications Director at UC San Diego Extension. This will be the first in a series of internet radio interviews with prominent and interesting guests who have a close connection with UC San Diego Extension and our courses and certificate programs. My first guest is Christopher Vera, who serves as Privacy Manager at SDG&E. Good morning, Chris. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. I'm honored to be the
Thank
first
you.
Guest.
It's good to have you. Let me do a quick introduction of you and what you do there, and then we'll just get into conversation, okay?
Absolutely.
So in his role, he develops and implements the Customer Privacy Program for SDG&E. And, of course, that's the utility firm that provides energy services to more than 3.5 million consumers throughout San Diego County and Orange County. And among his many professional specialties are cybersecurity strategy, incident response, vulnerability management, and security awareness. Chris is currently an advisor to UC San Diego Extension's Professional Certificate Program in Information Systems Management. And in that role, he's been instrumental in the development of that program. He formerly served as instructor for the extension course titled Information Security and Principles and Programs. On the job, he describes himself as an agent of positive and collaborative change, specializing in the building of information security systems. And away from cybersecurity, way away, he prefers to describe himself as a cyber poet, artist, musician, and writer within what he calls the mysterious cosmos. And we'll get into that, of course, because that's maybe among the more interesting aspects of your personality. So, welcome, Chris. Thank you for joining me again. To get things started, let's just get to the basics. Please tell our listeners what the most important thing is they need to know about internet privacy.
Yeah, that's great. Let's talk a little bit about privacy. That's one of my favorite topics, actually. I think that a lot of folks have expressed to me in the past that privacy is dead with the advent of social media, Facebook, Twitter, pictures being displayed on the internet in near real time. I mean, a lot of folks have kind of gotten under the impression that privacy is gone and that it just doesn't exist anymore. And I beg to differ. And when I hear people say that, what I'd like to ask them is, well, if you really believe privacy is dead, why don't you post your name, social security number, and your date of birth up on Twitter? And let's have a look at that. And I haven't anyone had accept that offer just yet, which means that I do believe that most reasonable people still do have an expectation of privacy, even in this modern age, that our information is being protected and is not being used against us for things. And we should probably talk a little bit about what privacy is at some point. But I think that the internet has not really changed the need for privacy. If anything, it's enhanced it. I think it has just made our ways of communicating a little bit faster, a lot faster, and is that's what's really changed here.
A friend of mine tweeted recently. Of course, he tweeted and didn't talk on my phone because phone is so old-fashioned. But he tweeted, "Help! Help! Help! Someone has stolen my privacy. I just got the phone book in the mail. It's got my address and phone number and my name." But of course, privacy and the expectations of privacy goes much, much further than that. What exactly do you do at SDG&E? What's your role?
So my role at SDG&E, we have built an Office of Customer Privacy, and my role is to manage that office. We actually built it up and put that program together, and now it's up to us to manage that program. And really our obligation is to ensure at the fundamental level that we have our customers' trust. Customers provide us information to provide them great products and services. If we're going to do that, fundamentally, they need to trust that we are protecting their information and their privacy, and that's my job, is to help be sure that that our customers' expectations are being met when it comes to their privacy, particularly their energy privacy.
Why should we trust SDG&E with our privacy?
That's a great question of any company, right? I mean, why would we trust any organization, whether it's a government organization or a private one, a company, with our information? And in our case, utilities in general in California, specifically with SDG&E, were held to rigorous standards when it comes to privacy. and protecting our customers' privacy in a lot of ways. There's actually several mandates that we have to meet, but even beyond those mandates, SDG&E has done a really good job of taking privacy seriously at the uppermost levels of the organization and ensuring that we are doing everything that we can to protect their privacy, not only on the privacy side, but also the information security side.
Mm-hmm. What, when you go to sleep at night and you've just spent a long, hard day on the job, what do you worry about most? Hackers?
If I look at it from the perspective of security, yeah, attackers coming in and trying to infiltrate systems and things of that nature are certainly a big worry. If I have my privacy hat on as a privacy manager, my biggest concern is how our information is being shared. So we have, and this is just, I'm going to speak in a generalization here. Various organizations, both governmental and private, are collecting information about us. How is that information being shared with third parties? And what are those third parties doing with that information? That's probably one of my personal biggest concerns when it comes to privacy is how is that information being collected, I think, is a fundamental issue. That's the one that we're trying to address now, right? The NSA has been in the news. Target was in the news. And I think that how that information is being collected, the information we carry around on our cell phones, the GPS data that's being transmitted here and there, I think that is certainly a concern. But even bigger than that is, what are they doing with that data? And that's one of the fundamental tenets of privacy. When you think about what privacy is, it means different things to different people. For some people, privacy is really just about wanting to be left alone. Just leave me alone and don't bother me. That's certainly one way to look at it. And I think another aspect of privacy is, I'm trusting to share my data with you, but I don't want that data to be used against me later. I think is a fundamental component of privacy, is that the reason why I signed up for this great service, be it Facebook or my utility service or whatever that thing might be, is that I'm expecting that the information is going to be used for that service and that service alone, and that it's not being used for other purposes that I was not aware of initially. And I think that is a major, fundamentally, I think that's going to be the biggest concern most consumers will have in regards to their privacy, is I'm happy to share my data with you, but who else am I sharing my data with if I share my data with you?
So the trust factor is the biggest factor in signing up for virtually anything, isn't it?
Absolutely. And in some cases, we're not as concerned. I download a new app on my phone. We just, you know, push the button to accept the terms and conditions of that new application. We really don't bother to read the 5 or 6 or 10 pages of.
Yes, I agree. Check that out.
Exactly, right? So we typically will just sign up for those things. And I think that the reasoning that we do that is that even though you may say, well, that's proof that there's no trust there, actually there is. My expectation is, regardless of what it says in that document, that you are going to reasonably protect my data and not do things with it that I didn't expect, that go beyond what that app's intention was. Mm-hmm. And while legally, you know, legal analysts may argue different points of that, I think that the general expectation is that if I'm downloading an app to, say, get great recipes on, that any information I give you is going to help me find great recipes and not be used for other things.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you taught your course here at Extension, what did you find rewarding? What did you find frustrating? What was the essence of teaching that course to you? And how has that changed maybe in the last couple of years?
The course in general or information security?
Well, just call it information security. How has that changed?
Yeah, so the course that I taught here at UCSD Extension was on information security. And we did touch on privacy too, because the two are very interrelated. They're not the same, but they're definitely interrelated. And what I really enjoyed about that course was when the students came in and were learning about it, at first it seems daunting, because information security can seem a little bit like voodoo.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, maybe it is. You have to have a certain mindset to really be an information security professional. But I think once you understand the basic principles of information security, you start to see everything in that light. And then suddenly you find yourself just, you know, where you leave your car parked at night, suddenly you're running through the security principles of least privilege. You know, who has the keys to this thing? And am I parked in a lighted space where, you know, people can monitor it and be sure that the car will be safe? I mean, it starts to touch everything that you do. And I think that is the value of it. In terms of what was frustrating about it, I don't know if I'd use the term frustration. I think if anything about that was just that there's so much to share. so much to teach that there's just not enough time to do it, even in the 9-week period that I had. It just felt like you're just scraping the surface of all the things that you could talk about in information security.
Tell me, how did you get involved in this security field, the security business? Tell me your roots in security.
Actually, my roots started in the IT field, which is where a lot of information security professionals begin. I was a system administrator. So I did my time on desktop support, and I managed servers, and you know, and I grew my technical skills as a system administrator, managing and network administrator, just managing networks and computer systems.
And I assume at SDG&E?
This was at various companies.
Oh, okay.
Probably
long
half
time
dozen
ago.
Companies throughout every, you know, from SAIC to a couple of startups that blew up in the .com era back in the late 90s, to LG that's over here in San Diego. So quite a few different organizations. But it was with SAIC that I really started learning more about information security specifically, became a security engineer, and started learning, you know, what is the relationship between security policy and security requirements, and how do those tie to the end functionality that you're really trying to develop, and then how do you test those requirements to be sure that all the security is actually in place and functioning as it should before the thing, the system, the application, whatever it is deployed.
What could possibly go wrong in the field of corporate security?
What could go wrong? Nothing could go wrong, right? No, I think that by now everyone understands, both in the corporate world, the government space, as well as even private citizens. I think just the average citizen you talk to on the street understands that there is no perfect security. Things break. There's weaknesses. You have very intelligent people trying to. Some of them supported by, in some cases, overseas states, you know, that are actually trying to figure out how to break into our system. So they're well funded.
We should say intelligent, but highly devious.
In some cases, very devious, right? And they have to do is find that one hole. So whereas a poor information security professional and system administrator managing a system has to figure out how to plug 100 holes, maybe 1,000 holes in any given network, or if it's a very large network, maybe tens of thousands of holes, the bad guys only have to find that one crack in there. And it's something that I think that people are beginning to understand, is that you can't have perfect security. What you really need to plan for is minimizing any damage that an intruder could do. If and when they do get in. I think that is really going to be the key.
Now, I want to go back even before you discovered IT. Tell me about your background. Tell me, you know, where you come from, who you are, what were you like as a kid, that kind of thing. I mean, were you a nerd? Were you one of the Revenge of the Nerds guys?
I'd like to think that I was. Yeah, I actually grew up here in San Diego, so I'm a San Diego native.
Yeah,
and I grew up with computers, you know, somewhere in the house.
So large computers. I'm thinking.
Back then you had to build them. So actually,
built your computer.
I don't know if you remember. You had to go to Heathkit, and Heathkit, you could buy a kit, and you would solder your first computer
that
together.
Seems like a long, long time.
It was a long time ago. I don't want to talk about how long ago that was, but you know, that was back in the days when San Diego had. That, you know, Convoy Street was full of computer stores.
Absolutely.
That were. I remember when VGA came out, you were like, "Wow, I can't believe how awesome that screen looks!" And look at all the colors. And nowadays,
Pong was very, very big.
Pong was big. I think I had every game console back in the day until there was just too many to keep track of. But I think that primarily is what I did for fun, was the computer games, and that's what kept me tied to the technology. Because you had to upgrade. In order to play the latest game, you needed the latest technology on your computer. And back then, you were building them, you know, ground up. I think they're a lot better now at prepackaging that stuff. And I think the technology is kind of keeping pace with software. But back then, it was really, I mean, they were making leaps and bounds. It seemed like every few months, you had to upgrade something.
Could you see yourself back then, I guess you're a kid then, as this is going to be my career, my life, my passion?
Well, interestingly enough, I think that I always knew that technology was going to be a part of my professional life. But actually, for my degree, when I went to San Diego State, and I actually got a degree in geological science. I wanted a hard science somewhere in there. So, but between my love of science and my love of technology, I knew that there was going to be something in there. And how one goes from a geological scientist to a IT professional, and then into information security, and now privacy, I think has been an interesting set of stepping stones. But ultimately, I think that they've all kind of served me in building up that.
So career. You're more of a science. You're guided by your interest in science, most of all, right?
And I
so it's
do.
The science of technology.
I really do enjoy the science aspect of things, especially the way that science is trying to explain mysteries that are, you know, unexplainable. I really dig that. To me, that's always been big. I think that the Earth is our mothership. That's why I thought geology was really fantastic. What better system to understand than planet Earth?
All right. What's the bit for your geology degree? What's the most important thing that you learned that relates now to what you do?
When I first got hired into an IT, the manager was looking at my resume and said,
yeah.
"You're a geologist, right? You have this geology degree.
What are you
degree.
Doing here?
How are you going to apply that to IT?" And without skipping a beat, I looked him in the eye and I told him, "Geology gave me the ability to look at a whole set of disparate, very large systems and understand how they interact together. And it's the same thing in IT. You've got major networks all together doing different things with specific purposes." One change in one of them has dramatic changes in other parts of it. And he bought it. so I did get that job. There is that tight relationship there. Is that I think that what my degree taught me is to be able to step back and look at the 50,000-foot level, so to speak. Mm-hmm. How do all these pieces fit and work together? And that's very good for strategic thinkers in technical spaces especially. But also if you're managing new programs, is to really try to think, how do all these pieces fit together? How am I going to make it work? And if I make a change here, how is that going to affect something somewhere else?
Mm-hmm. Now, going back to kind of at the ground level, the consumer level, what tips can you give consumers, just regular people, as to how to protect that most precious of things, our privacy? Mm. What should they do?
Well, so there's
basics.
There's a lot. Let's start on the security side first.
Sure.
I think from a security perspective, what the things are that folks should be thinking about aren't. You can Google it and find out. There's really the big three. You really should. You need to have some kind of a firewall to protect your network, whatever that means,
Done.
Or your
Done.
System. You should have your antivirus updated. And,
Done.
Of course, you should be updating your system software. That's the basic stuff.
How often should you update?
As often as the patches come out. So, you know, organizations like Microsoft, most applications, but even Microsoft especially, they have this automatic patching feature that handles that stuff. And generally, it's once a month, roughly speaking. If there's a big critical emergency vulnerability that's discovered, sometimes it will happen sooner than that. But that's just the basics. So let's get those out of the way, because everyone should know that by now. Whether or not we do it.
I have one more question about the basics.
Oh, please.
How often should you change your password?
That's a great question.
And I don't want to change my password. It's in my head now.
The answer to that question is, it depends on the risk that you are willing to accept in not changing your password. So in our organizations, in information security and in privacy, you really have to think in terms of risk. I can't protect everything. How do I decide where I'm going to invest my limited resources in protecting what I do have? And so when it comes to passwords, for example, in your own personal life, some systems you just don't care about. You know, honestly, I think I have an email account on Yahoo and Gmail and Hotmail. Some of those I really don't care about. They're almost just buckets to drop spam when people, you know, ask for my email address. I don't change my password very often in those, because honestly, if it gets broken into, I'm not going to lose much sleep.
You would not change it.
Well, I have changed it, and I do change it, but not as often, say, as I might change my bank account.
Would a smart person change their bank account number?
So generally speaking, you want to be looking at that, again, depending on your level of risk that you're willing to tolerate, probably no more than a year, and probably 3 to 6 months is probably something that you should be thinking about. And that password should be fairly difficult to guess. So one thing that I like to tell people is, you normally hear from the security professionals, oh, you should have a uppercase letter, lowercase, you should have numbers and special characters and all of that. And I actually prefer not to use that method, because it's impossible to remember it without writing it down. I prefer the longer is stronger method, and you use passphrases. Think about your favorite line from your favorite movie. Think about a favorite poem that you know, and find a line in there that really strikes you, and use something like that as a poem. Use that as a password. I think that is really a good way to look at putting together a password. When passwords are really long and strong, they're much more difficult to guess. They're less likely to be broken into by an attacker. And the bigger fear probably is that an attacker breaks into the bank and steals all the passwords.
Everything, not just
and
yours.
And then they require you to change your password at that point.
Okay, so we've talked about science. And let's move on to something somewhat related, but maybe far, far beyond. Science fiction.
Oh, fiction.
Do you like science fiction, do you?
I absolutely love science fiction.
I have a sense of that because on your website, as I say, you describe yourself as a cyber poet, a musician, and an artist, and you have a book out.
A couple of them.
Well, the latest that I know of is called, and it's a very curious title, is called The Left Hand of Light.
That's it.
Tell me, what is, I happen to be left-handed. What is the left hand of light? What does it mean?
Well, the whole idea behind that book is that you always kind of look at things in terms. People often look at things in terms of good and evil, and that's I kind of wanted to use that analogy, but without using more of a light and darkness. You know, everyone's got kind of a light and darkness in them, and so one of my real passions right now on, you know, what I do at night, you know, my day job is privacy security.
We're talking nighttime stuff.
My night job now is to really kind of examine this relationship between science and the mystical. And so things that we deem as mystical or magic or things that we can't understand.
Unexplainable.
Really do have a tight relationship in science in a lot of different ways. And so this book is kind of my attempt to take a look at what does something like the afterlife really look like? You know, what is that? Is it a heaven and hell kind of thing? Well, I want to take a different perspective on it. And to me, it's really fundamentally what it comes down to in science is energy. Energy is what makes up matter, and then matter is then reconverted to energy. You never lose or gain energy. It's kind of a zero-sum game. It's always there. It just changes. It transforms, right? It changes its state. And that's what I wanted to explore in this book is what happens to us and what is the soul? What does the soul mean? And how does the soul equate to energy? And what happens then when that energy changes? What happens to the energy of our souls when it leaves the flesh of our body and goes into a different state?
Well, that's a fine question. What does happen?
well, in the book, it really starts moving into just different universes, right? So there's this whole idea that there are different universes, and the main character in the book, one of them, his name is Michael, and he has been given this ability to move between these universes while staying in his corporeal body. Whereas some people will tell you, if you ever had this, they'll use the term astral traveling, you know, and this ability to look at, you know, this out-of-body experience. People have talked about having these kind of experiences. And even average people have kind of had that experience themselves, this ability that you're looking down on yourself. Mm-hmm. Well, what is that? And what does that mean?
Near
and how
death
does that
experiences
work?
Type, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so what do those things really mean? And that moving into a different universe is kind of my explanation for that in the book. And this gentleman has the ability to cross over into this other place while he's looking for the soul of his lost love. And that's fundamentally what the story is. It's this journey about this man looking for the soul of his lost love.
Well, I'm going to read one paragraph of what's on your website and as a description of the book. And then, are you prepared to read a short excerpt from the book?
I can give you a little excerpt,
good.
Yeah.
So here's the first paragraph. So this is The Left Hand of Light by Christopher Vera. After the tragic deaths of Michael's lover and their child at the hand of the Shadow Queen, the mysterious Golden Man grants him the ability to travel to the spirit world to rescue their souls.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that a good enough introduction?
That is a fantastic introduction.
Okay. What do you have?
And so one of the things that I'm going to do is share with you, this is one of my favorite characters in the book, actually, is one of the antagonists. His name is Zizek. So what's happening is Michael is being pursued by this spirit creature that really just cannot stand him because of the Shadow Queen's interest in him. So the Zizek is a minion of the Shadow Queen.
It's
tough
to keep track of all these, by the way. This is kind of like what's that? The Russian novel.
There's a few. There's not too many characters in it, but the ones.
Doctor Zhivago is what I'm trying to.
Yeah, think. Right, yeah. Right. It's not that busy.
Okay, all right.
But there's a few in there.
Go ahead.
All right. So this is a description of that character when the main character Michael and the female protagonist in the book Jaylena find themselves in a lighthouse being attacked by this creature.
Good.
The dark being stood in a chamber below them, balanced on two muscular and carapace legs bent backwards like the hindquarters of an insect. It looked huge by human standards, maybe 9 feet tall. Its face, if it could be called a face, had oozing lumps and distortions, as if two heads had been smashed together. and in places its brain seemed to have burst from its skull like grotesque mushrooms that pulsated, releasing clouds of red spores into the air around it. Jaylena saw its rows of teeth, and in each of its four twisted limbs it grasped a different weapon, an axe, a sword, a spike club, and a cat of nine tails. Behind it, trailing back into the darkness, lay an iron chain the thickness of a man's leg. The chain reminded Jaylena of her own silver cord that appeared when she had crossed over. The creature seemed to be tied to a corporal form on the other side. It didn't make sense, but nothing about what she had seen that night had made much sense.
Well, I it's kind of a transition there, but that does actually, oddly enough, make sense to me, what you just read. So I'm going to read some of the tweets. We got just a few minutes left. So, and you tweet frequently, and many of them are interesting and perhaps intriguing. So I'm going to read a few, and then maybe you can comment on one or two. This is one relating to your day job. No one cares a lick about privacy until it's their privacy that's been invaded. Right?
Yeah. That's and that I remember when I tweeted that I was hearing about some people. An event had just occurred, and some people's privacy had just been violated on some website that they were at. And suddenly, they're up in arms about privacy, where they hadn't had any concern before, but suddenly now it was theirs that had been violated, and it did. And that's the mindset I want to change. I want everyone to be concerned about their privacy all the time, and not just think that you're safe in the herd. We are not safe in the herd. Mm-hmm. Any one of us could be picked off at any time. In fact, in large numbers. So we really need to be concerned about our privacy and ensure that companies that and governments that have our information are also concerned about it.
So here's another one on a lighter side. I think I've killed a million ants. All their little souls haunt me in my dreams.
I wrote a poem about ants once, and so, you know, it's your house gets the ants going in it, so you got to clean the ants out. And in a way, it's a bit sad, you know, because the ants are just there to do one thing, and that's all they're there to do. But still, we have this kind of, you know, a desire not to have ants in our homes. And as I'm sitting there wiping up the mess of all these ants in the place, it got me to thinking that, wow, that's a lot of little souls just heading on up into the ether, right? And so that got me, you know, related to that book, right, is that even ants have some kind of energy in their little bodies. And what happens to that energy once you squish it out, right? And that kind of touched me in a way that I thought I should tweet something about it.
Okay, so it begs the question, well, what happens to those little guys? They're souls. Don't they matter?
So the short answer, of course, is yes. The larger answer, I think, from a universal perspective, is that none of it really matters. And so that kind of got me to this whole idea of the difference between wanting and needing. That's actually a philosophical argument I was having with someone. And you ask them, what do you need, really? Well, you need air, and you need food, you need water. Well, no, you don't need. The universe doesn't need that. You know, if the whole planet was snuffed out in an instant, would the universe care? Probably not. The universe keeps on chugging away doing what the universe does.
So there's a caring universe out there?
So, well, there's probably not. It's probably extremely neutral. So energy is energy. It doesn't care whether that energy is in the form of Chris Vera or an ant or an entire planet or an entire galaxy, right? I mean, it's churning through those things, you know, every second of every day, so to speak. And so in terms of a universal perspective, there is no need. There's only want for us human beings, right?
Mm-hmm.
I want air because I would like to live a little bit longer, right? I want food so that I can continue to sustain myself. But in terms of need on a universal scale, it's, dare I say, arrogant for us to think that we need anything, right?
Well, I'd rather have my air and be arrogant.
Yes, please. I'll accept a little bit of arrogance for the moment.
So I have one more tweet, and it says, you want to know who I am? Hurt me and find out quick, or take the time to mindfully know me. One requires more energy than the other.
Yeah, which one?
I like
one?
That. I think we just spent 30 minutes getting to know you.
Yeah. Yes, and I appreciate that.
Thing.
Thank you. I appreciate
and I think
you hurting me.
No harm was done.
I definitely appreciate that. And I think that was... when we look at our relationships, our interrelationships between each other, and that's also something that the book really examines, is these interpersonal relationships between people, is there's two ways to really get to know someone. You know, if you hurt them, you're really going to find out who they are quick, you know, and that takes energy. There's repercussions to that, action, reaction. So, it's going to require some energy. One requires a lot of energy, one more than the other. Which one really is the one that takes the more energy? I think in the long run, it's better to get to know people before we hurt them.
Well, this has been a pleasure, Chris. You're really a fascinating fellow.
Thank you.
SDG&E is very, very fortunate to have you, as we are at UC San Diego Extension. So thank you for joining me. Terrific. I'm very pleased with the first edition of Emerging Trends. So it's been a fascinating look into the trends of this fast emerging field that impacts all of our lives. I'm going to be quite, probably change my password more frequently than I do now, which is probably never. So certainly this privacy issue is something that we need to keep learning about as it changes, I guess every year or two, doesn't it? The whole concepts of these
It continues to evolve, and so should our understanding of those privacy mm-hmm. principles.
So for UC San Diego Extension's Emerging Trends, this is John Freeman. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks, Chris.
Thank you for having me.